Hello, Denim Heads. Welcome to the 23rd Hangout with the Sons of Selvage. This is a podcast where a group of friends get together to talk about denim, rugged wear, and related interests. We aim for this to be a fun and inclusive podcast where you feel like you're hanging out with longtime friends, but be warned, there's a bit of banter, cutting up, and explicit language. In this episode, we'll be hanging out with our good friend Chris Chasseau, talking about his UK-based knitwear brand, Malux. Perfect as we're in the middle of a winter spell here in London and need to stay warm. So I guess maybe to kick things off, Chris, welcome to the show. It's good to have you on the podcast.
Hi there, thanks.
Awesome. Welcome, and I guess maybe, oh, sorry, Leah, go ahead.
I was just saying welcome, Chris.
Tom does not think you're welcome.
Tom's still on mute.
God damn it. Good stuff.
Cool. Well, I guess maybe to kick things off, maybe Chris, you could tell us a bit about what Malux is.
Sure. Malux is a British knitwear brand. With the whole USP of making and championing British manufacturing. So the easiest way to sort of say is I am created something that merges a crossover between classic styling and knitwear, along with contemporary approach to dressing, shall we say. I have listened to a few of your, I think it was the last podcast you did on archetypes, and it's very interesting to hear how obviously you have people dressing a certain way, you know, and almost do it religiously. I'm doing something where I try and cover lots of different bases, shall we say. Like it's a classic knit, but you can style it and mix it with denim, with tailoring, maybe even with sportswear. So it's trying to be a nice crossover, shall we say.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I was on the website this morning just kind of having a browse, and I saw that for one of your jumpers or sweaters, as they call it, across the pond. As the Shetland, you're talking about this idea of like being able to kind of wear it with that Ivy League style look, where you've got your, you know, your Oxford cloth button down shirt under the jumper. Maybe absolutely, you've got the collar tucked in and buttons. Maybe you've got it over the top and your shirt's untucked. And for me, that's always been like the pinnacle of how I like to wear a jumper. It's like, I love that kind of sort of preppy, but sort of kind of not being too preppy look, and I felt like that was really cool to see you sort of touting that way of wearing your stuff.
Yeah, no, thanks. I mean, the challenge always is any sort of small brand, you have to portray yourself. So photography imagery is always important, because that sort of informs your customer or future customers what you have, how they can wear it, as well as the fit. I personally don't want to be limiting people to, you know, a certain framework of you have to wear it like this, you have to style it like that. And I think we're in an age where people are, should we say, intelligent enough to know what works for them, but sometimes need a guide or inspiration. So that is the thing. But I'm, you know, I can't do one jumper and then 20 images in all different styles, because that would just take ages to do. But the idea is to encourage people that they can venture or wear it in different ways. The fascinating thing I find is, you know, you hear back from customers, you see photographs online and stuff, as well as some of my wholesale clients, but everyone styles in different ways. And I find that really exciting, because I can have an idea of like what something fits. I'm sure you guys might have the same when it comes to denim or certain clothes, but it's interesting to see how people interpret it in different ways. So some of my Japanese clients, they go for the real oversized fit. Some of my maybe more European, let's say classic customers, go for more a traditional fitted fit. And I find that, really interesting.
Yeah, and one thing that kind of came to mind was, and it's kind of jumping a bit into more of the detail of the brand, but, you know, I think it's relevant for what you're describing is you've obviously got, like, you know, four different general styles of knitwear, jumpers or sweaters, whatever you want to call them. And you've got your scarves, you've got your wool hats and everything. What led you to choose those four particular styles, and, like, how do they differ? Because I think if you're a big knitwear fan, you probably know what chunky versus fine is, or wool versus cotton. Like, can you maybe tell us a bit about each of the styles and kind of what their purpose is?
Sure, absolutely. So things like the fine lamb's wool. So all my knitwear is currently lamb's wool, but I have a fine range and a chunkier range. Obviously in the fine, it's a finer gauge, so it's a tighter knit. The chunky knit is a heavier gauge, so you get a heavier ply yarn to give more of a robust chunky feel. That can obviously come to different styling. My personal feeling is the finer knit is better for those who want to go for a smarter look or more layering. So for example, like I said, I want to do lots of crossovers. So in the fine knit, I have crew necks or V-necks, cardigans, but with the idea is you can wear it to work, but then you can also wear it at home and be casual. So it's that crossover, like, rather than having clear garments which are work only and relaxed only, you know, you can mix it up.
And on the website, you've got Shetland is its own category. Is that a different type of wool, or is that like just your most popular style? Like, why is that kind of on its own?
So yeah, Shetland is a unique wool, completely different in quality. As it says on the tin, it's from Shetland Isles. So the fascinating thing that I find with wool is, depending on the climate that the sheep are reared, you get a different quality of wool. Obviously, because of the Shetland Isles being so remote and quite harsh conditions, the sheep have to have, you know, climatized to grow a very tight and coarse sort of wiry wool to keep them warm. But then that quality also can extend to jumpers itself. Whereas if you have sheep from southern hemispheres, like Australia, New Zealand, they have a warmer climate. So their fibers are a lot softer. So those qualities can play into different in garments. But going to your question, why I have a section of just Shetland, I love the quality of Shetland. And I think there's, I want to say in the past couple of years, a bit of a moment in Shetland knitwear. Like, it's always been there, as you said, like with Ivy League style. But I think it's definitely having a moment where people are going for maybe more weird look. So, for example, you can have a brushed Shetland, which can give it almost like an aged vintage look, but it's brand new. But yeah, I'm fascinated by the qualities of the yarn and wool and how that can affect in the knitting process, like how loosely knitted it is, tighter knitted, as well as the sort of the handle and feel when you're wearing it.
I hadn't realized that it's almost like terroir for wool. I mean, when you go to like a factory, do you like lick the wool and get the flavors of the terroir and smell it and all that kind of stuff?
Well, you can definitely smell the difference. Like Shetland wool, some of my Shetlands, they have this unique quality to it. It's maybe people have different sensitive like awareness of how things smell, but definitely like a fresh knit, you can smell that, like a fresh pair of shoes or something, like leather or sneakers or something.
And I guess maybe this is an obvious one, but I know some people are like really sensitive about wool against the skin. Like I myself don't mind it. I could wear a wool jumper with nothing under it and be comfortable. But it seems like the obvious thing would be that like the fine knit's probably the easiest to have against you. How does the Shetland and the chunky compare?
So Yeah, Shetland is just going to be, let's say, I wouldn't say itchier. I wouldn't say it's completely itchy. It's just a more coarse fiber. So you might, those with sort of sensitive skin are going to feel that. A lot of the mills have really improved over the years. So they do a bit more of a washing treatment to make it softer. But it'll still have that sort of slightly coarse quality. One thing that I think's quite unique and amazing in making knitwear in Scotland is Scotland has very soft water, actually. So in the whole knitting process and garment washing, using that water helps soften up the garment anyway, which is different to London water, which is a lot harder. So that's quite a unique quality that they have.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I know where I'm at, the lime scale is crazy. It feels like when you're bathing, you know, you're like in a salt mine or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a bad metaphor, but. And I guess maybe kind of stepping back a bit. So I remember getting one of your wool hats a couple years ago, well, actually more than a couple years ago now, when you're kind of first getting things started. And you know, it's still the warmest hat I have, and it's nice. Great for when it gets really cold. How did the brand get started? Like, what was your inspiration, and kind of like, how did you get it off the ground? And like, maybe tell us about the early days.
Sure. Yeah. So I have been working in the fashion industry for over a decade. It feels like a long, long time. But I actually come from a graphic design background. That's what I trained in. And while I was freelancing, I helped a friend launch a fashion brand. So that was my sort of introduction, or proper introduction to fashion, where it came to manufacturing, sampling, sales, all this kind of stuff. But from that, I sort of grew my interest and fascination with clothing and garments. Then after that, I started working with a few other brands, but I always had the interest to do my own brand. But then thinking in more like feasible terms, how to start, rather than, you know, anyone can have the interest to do a full look brand, but it's going to cost X amount of money, which we don't all have. So what was the easiest, best way to start? So I sort of researched those options, you know, with me either wanting to do coats and outerwear, tailoring, denim. I actually wanted to start doing accessories, like ties and pocket squares, because it was that time, it was very, in London at least, it was very sort of a sartorial look, and people were wearing ties and pocket squares a lot more than they are now. But I had a realization, thinking, hang on, I've got friends who are doing this, so why enter this category? So I did more research, and I had more of a, let's say, a passion to work with British manufacturing, to sort of champion that area, because there used to be hundreds, if not thousands, of factories. And yeah, it's just less and less of them, unfortunately, but I just wanted to champion that arena. So I started small, got a few jumpers. I was working with another brand, and I managed to sell it at their store, just to like slowly pay for itself. Obviously, whatever I was earning, putting it aside to help slowly grow the collection. And then I wrote a large order so I could start selling myself direct. And it's sort of, it's been a, I want to say, a side project for definitely the first couple of years, but it's gathering pace and growing, which is great. Like, you sort of look back at the business plan of what your goals and ideas are. And when you look back and think, oh, I've done that, tick, 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 you're like, great, what's next? So yeah, that's sort of like my background and inspiration.
I guess maybe thinking a bit about the design process, how do you decide like what pieces you want in your collection, right? Like, because you've obviously got different different styles, different accessories? Like, how are you picking what to include versus not?
Very good question. Well, the over the years, it's definitely grown in categories or styles. So I started off with a handful, like the fine knit, crew neck, V-neck, and a roll neck, and that was it. And it's sort of grown and grown. And I guess for me, it's where I want Mallocks to be is rather than a fashion brand. I'm doing pieces which are timeless, so perennial styles that people can come back to over and over and over, rather than giving myself the hassle of having to do something new every single season. Even though, shall we say, I'm introducing new styles, the old ones will still exist, but you can get very excited in the whole process of getting ideas what to do, but reality bites and the dust settles, you think, oh, maybe I can only do one rather than 10. So it's just sort of slowly expanding that, but for me, at least, keeping perennial styles that people can keep coming back to, as well as colorways. So I have a deep interest and fascination with color, and obviously color plays a big part in people's wardrobes, like what they associate with, what people maybe interpret about them, because if, let's say, that you, yeah, certain colors can show off and resonate a different character, shall we say. So I know men will mostly buy navies, grays, charcoals, and blacks, so that's the sort of the cornerstone, but I also want to introduce other colors that can inject a bit more. So whether brighter colors or unique colorways, and I try and get inspiration from, shall we say, the British countryside or the seaside. So certain colors that I see to try and bring it into a piece of knitwear. So for example, I've got a few styles which are like a marl, where it's two different colored yarns knitted together. So it gives the, as you know, with the marl, like, you get, the closer you are, you see it, but the further away, it just looks like a different, more unique color. And I like that that quality, where if you see it from a distance, but the closer someone gets to you, it it evolves into something else. And that's a quality I really like.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because that's been like a standout for me. Like the hat I got from you those years ago, it's got kind of like dark navy, but also kind of like a dark olive. Yeah. Kind of mixed together, and when you step away, it doesn't look navy or olive. It looks like something different.
Exactly.
But then up close, you see those details. And I know, like, I was on the Clutch Cafe website looking at some of your stuff there as well this morning, and there was some interesting kind of like two-tone wools, where it's like it kind of is its own color, but then you look up close, it's like a mix.
Exactly.
Of colors.
So, well, that's another thing. So in a lot of the dyeing of the yarn, you can get some yarn which is very flat and solid, so you get a solid color all the way through. Others in the dyeing process, where as you mentioned, you can get a bit more of a sort of a mixed color, so some a bit darker, some a bit lighter. So once that's then knitted all together, you get a really sort of unique garment. And with that yarn, you can almost say each garment is then unique, because rather than being a solid colored yarn, it's almost like a grainy colored yarn, but then knitted together, it's quite unique.
And do you ever do hybrid fabrics? The reason why I say that is, like, I'm a bit of a fanboy of Apollos, as I've mentioned before, and they used to do this indigo dyed wool, which arguably was actually wool, cotton, polyester blend, I think like 60, 30, 10 or something like that. And it was kind of, they were able to indigo dye it. I'm not sure if it was the wool or the cotton or both that took the dye. But it kind of was this interesting fabric where it wasn't really wool, it wasn't really cotton, it's some kind of weird other thing. And it's quite nice in its own way. And I'm just wondering, like, do you ever dabble in that kind of stuff, or do you stick to 100% wool?
Right now, just sticking to 100% wool. Like I said, I probably just mixed with the colors to give that different quality. I am probably looking to expand my product categories. And if I do that, then then the fabric will have probably different percentages and mixes. So right now I've just been a winter brand and looking to expand to spring summer, which I would love to do as a link and a crossover. Then I would definitely be looking at cotton, potential blends like merino and cashmere or cotton cashmere, just for that, for those warmer months.
And can you do indigo dye on wool? Does it work, or is it? I wonder if that particular fabric was the cotton dyed.
I haven't tried it, so I don't know. I wouldn't know how well it retains it. Obviously, we know wool can soak up a lot. I'm sure someone has tried it, and if they have, then let's hear about it. I would probably think it would then come down to how someone would wear it. Like what the transfer would be like, how often they wash it, because people do think you need to wash, you're just used to washing things regularly, but knitwear you kind of don't, so depending on how often they would wear an indigo dyed wool garment, and how that transfers, or like you say, you might need to do a blend just to sort of retain it a bit more.
I think you see a lot more cotton-based indigo-dyed knitwear because cotton takes the indigo much better. I haven't seen too much indigo wool products, to be honest, and I don't know whether that's because of the natural oils and things like lanolin that is within the wools that actually, you know, push it out, or it's not that easy for it to take it in. Although I'm sure there are some synthetics which can, you know, get around those kind of things, but whether it will fade, you know, in the way that David is kind of thinking about, I don't know. Like I said, you'll see a lot of cotton cable knits out there.
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, I've got an idea. So I was at Superdrug, which is like a UK pharmacy, and I was walking past the hair dye section because it's near the checkout, and there's a brand, I just Googled it, called Schwarzkopf Live Ultra Bright or Pastel Blue Hair Dye. So basically it's like a hair dye that dyes your hair denim colored. So I'm just saying it now. We can get a bunch of wool, buy a whole bunch of boxes of that hair dye, dye it indigo, and there we go, sorted.
So you could probably try that as a garment dye. So rather than dyeing the yarn from the beginning, you get one of your own garments, hopefully like a lighter shade, then garment dye that and see what happens.
Yeah. I like Chris saying, get one of your own garments. don't touch mine.
Well, that's not even considering the fact that, you know, it's hair dye, which is God knows how horribly chemical, and who knows what's in that shit. But anyways. Cool. And I guess maybe an interesting one was, you kind of alluded to summer and warmer times. Like, I know a lot of places in the world, even in the middle of summer, you know, it gets cool in the evening, you know, like San Francisco, for example, right? Like, it'd be t-shirt, maybe light long sleeve shirt weather in the middle of summer, but like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, all of the Pacific layer fog rolls in over the city and it gets really cold. So like in the middle of summer, you need knitwear there. But I'm interested to kind of see what you might want to bring forth with that.
In terms of knitwear, or just like expanded categories?
The latter, just like kind of what you might want to do in summer.
Loads. I've actually always been wanting to outerwear. So I've really developed a pattern for a coat. And it's sort of been sitting and waiting to be sampled before production, but I just had to be very smart with myself not to go forward with that, but it's there. But yeah, I think anything lighter weight, like I was just at a textile fair the other week looking at potential fabrics. I'm a big fan of linen, personally, and I think linen's a great sort of crossover between let's say a regular cotton and know, something else, because it's got a different quality, and you can use it in shirting, in outerwear, trousers. Like, not to say I would go into tailoring and stuff, but I just like that versatility of linen. So you can go for a lighter one or a heavy one. So that might be a fabric I end up exploring more.
Linen's a really interesting one. So I did a summer holiday in Greece this summer, and we were primarily in like the Cyclades Islands. And when you're going into like local shops there, like everything's linen, right? It's like linen shirts, linen kind of blazers, linen trousers. And it's almost like you have these like shops where it's like a whole wardrobe just of linen garments. And like, it feels like no one's kind of done that in a cool way, or like a fashion way. I'm not sure the right term, but like contemporary and interesting, you know? So you might be onto something there.
Yeah, I mean, it's all down to your local climate. Like obviously being here in the UK, we don't, traditionally doesn't get too hot, even though we've had to have a couple of hot summers or just a couple of days, but in a way that doesn't warrant doing a full collection, but just a couple of pieces. But no, I know what you mean, like somewhere like in there, you just need a really lighter fabric, and getting a very fine linen will help for breathing. I personally also really like seersucker, but that's not something I might introduce into my collection, but that has the same sort of qualities where seersucker would help you. It's a fabric as in a garment. It will help you breathe when you're in a warmer climate.
Knitwear shorts?
Yes, but not maybe for me. I don't know.
That sort of sounded no.
I mean, not for me. I think so currently I obviously work with traditional like knitters and manufacturers, and not to say there are certain limitations, but that might be, you have to sort of really set the machines up in a different way. But yeah, I'm sure it's something you could explore. Or long johns, maybe. That might be a bit more effective.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But interest.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, like, so some of the challenges I found with working with UK manufacturers is I obviously at the very very beginning wanted to do really lightweight, like polos, like fine gauge knits, and there are very few factories in the UK doing it. And I approached a particular brand who are very well known and renowned in the world, who I absolutely love. I've got some like old pieces. They used to do a lot of private label stuff. They don't anymore, and that's the problem. So I was just saying, there's a particular knitwear brand and manufacturer who are sort of renowned in the world for fine gauge knits. They don't produce private label anymore. Which is a shame, because it then makes a lot of younger brands who want to explore those sort of weights, who are unable to produce it in the UK, and then they go abroad to either Portugal or Italy, who can do it. And I just find that a shame. I'd love to do it myself here. It would, you know, to get the machinery would cost a lot as a young brand. So it's just a shame that those things aren't available. It's all down to costing as well, and obviously you get more attractive prices abroad than you do in the UK, hence why, again, it's my choice. I want to be UK produced, but then the prices reflect that.
And is there anything kind of characteristic wise about UK made as well, that like beyond just the provenance, like is there anything that kind of when something's made here, you know, because of X, right? There's like kind of unique features, or is it really just about the provenance?
Probably more the provenance. I mean, certain garments, you can have the quality, like Shetland. Some brands are producing Shetland in like their jumpers in Italy or Portugal, using the same sort of wool, probably from the same or similar mills, but producing over there. some of the machines are over here in the UK or in Scotland are hundreds of years old, so you have that that quality in the knitting process. Whereas maybe in a modern factory in Italy, it would be a bit cleaner, shall we say. I personally like the I don't say the roughness, but the that sort of older quality in the jumper, shall we say, in the knit, rather than a cleaner manufactured piece. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like texture, feel, yeah. You know, kind of ruggedness.
But technically, like, you know, the older machines have that. The newer ones, you could probably have similar machines in factories all over the world, and they would produce basically identical garments. As I said earlier, definitely it's down to the washing process. So Scottish water is softer and gives it that sort of nice finish. So that's definitely a unique quality that they have up there.
That's kind of what I was alluding to a bit, because I was imagining, like, you know, back when cone mills was still around, they weren't doing different denim per se at the White Oak plant, right? But it was just the combination of their dye process, their cotton they selected, the specific shuttle looms they had, and kind of like all that together made this kind of unique selling point of cone denim. And it sounds a bit like the sort of like Scottish wool kind of has something like that, and alongside with the factories who are making it here in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sounds like we'll probably need to do like a podcast adventure where we go up there and just drink a bunch of scotch and tag along to follow you to the different mills and stuff. And
yeah, for sure.
Have a good time.
For sure.
Yeah, I'm in.
Count me in. Yep.
I wonder if anyone ever goes to Scotland without the intention of like mixing a scotch trip into the itinerary. It's like such an amazing, amazing thing.
Yeah, if you do go, you have to come back with whiskey. It's the given.
Cool. Well, I think I've covered most of the main questions I had kind of sketched out ahead of time. I don't know, Ilya and Tom, if you guys want to ask anything specific on Above and Beyond.
Yeah, no, I've got one. If you could make your dream product, what would it be? Like, no holds barred, just the dream product you could make.
Good question. I'd probably do some sort of outerwear or a jacket, maybe like a chore jacket, just because I like them and they're very versatile. I use them a lot, pockets galore, because I love to stuff things in pockets. So something that I would wear and use all the time.
Nice. Any dream fabric to go with it?
No, maybe a heavy cotton, maybe a linen version. Yeah, I don't know. It's a great question because I haven't really put too much thought into that, but probably something that I would just get loads of wear out of. This is a very selfish thing. Like, maybe I'll just do one sample and do it for me.
Yeah, make a sample.
Exactly.
I wonder if you could do something where it's like a wool chore coat, but with like cotton lining and stuff to kind of reinforce the pocket, so like your objects don't ruin the wool, but it's still ultimately a wool garment at the end of the day.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. Definitely. That was going to be my question, whether you would have anything heavier, wool-based, like an outerwear piece.
Yes, I'd love to explore that. I'll be also honest, it's just very expensive to get that sort of fabric. So if I were to explore those sort of things, I would definitely sample it, but do sort of pre-order so that the customers can help pre-order, and then I have money to work with, because I am a small brand and it just costs a lot of money to do that kind of stuff. Obviously, I've entered wholesale, which is great, and if I get orders from clients, then I know that, you know, you can go to certain factories to write those orders, but it's the whole process of buying the meters of that fabric all up front, then sending it to the factories. So it's just making sure my cash flow can work with that.
Sure. I think a made to order program would be quite interesting to introduce.
At
some point, you know, when you're ready, because I think that would be quite a nice inclusive or exclusive thing to do.
The thing with that, and I'm sure you guys know or kind of recognize with certain factories or brands that doing MTO is great. You need to have a good factory for that, but still either you work with a fabric supplier where you can then buy certain cut lengths for that process, or you still have to buy, let's say, 100 or 200 meters and work into that. So there are different ways of working in it. So I guess it's finding the right fabric that resonates with Malox as a brand, as well as being like economical for that reason. So this is definitely like a new area I personally want to explore, because I am currently just using knitting manufacturers. I did actually use Black Horse Lane Atelier for some tote bags, because I haven't mentioned, but I used to work with them, and I'm very excited in that their processes and the quality, and it's to use factories in that sort of manner where it can be CMT versus the knitting.
And for those who don't know, CMT means cut, make, and trim, right? Which is basically doing the manufacture, like the assembly, let's call it, of the garment.
Yeah, exactly. So you buy you supply them with the fabric and the patterns, and then they would make it for you. Whereas like the knitting factories are slightly different, where you they would be knitting a pattern rather than cutting it. So it's you kind of get the yarn separately, supply it to them, and it's more unique in that way.
Actually, one thing we kind of skimmed over a little bit, Chris, but we didn't really talk much about, was around acquiring products from your brand. So I'm on the website, which is mallochs.co.uk, mm-hmm. which is to enable customers to buy direct from you. And I also see that you've got UK stockists and a couple of Japan stockists. So maybe if you want to tell us a little bit about how one might go about acquiring one of your garments.
Absolutely. So obviously, going to the website, mallochs.co.uk is probably the best place, because you've got everything there. I luckily, as you said, I've got some wholesale stockists, so they are selling, let's say, an edit. So some of them have unique colorways that you can't get on my website. So that's what clubs have, and some of my Japanese clients. I'm hoping to expand that, obviously, as it happens and I know it, then it will be updated onto the website. That's something I definitely want to be exploring for EU, just because with Brexit it's definitely impacted EU customers. So hopefully by next year I'll have a few EU stockists that customers can get direct from. But obviously, like, everyone will have a smaller buy, but on the website you can see everything.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning too, for folks who are visiting London, if you go by Clutch Cafe, which is one of the stockists Chris mentioned, it's maybe like a 5-minute walk from Oxford Circus. So you can be right in the middle of London, pop over there and sort of see the stuff in person, which is really cool. Definitely seems like a nice way to kind of get to try out the brand in person, see what size fits, and then go online and kind of order to your heart's content. All right, so next up, we'll jump over to current interest. And our guest, Chris from Malox, is going to be hanging out with us today. So, Chris, do you have anything you'd like to mention?
Sure. So current interest is a bit unique, because I am running the London Marathon in the spring. So I've been starting my training. So I've been doing a ton of research on footwear and gear, which is very different from denim and indigo, but also non-alcoholic beers. And I have to say, there are loads of breweries out there doing some really good stuff, and I was quite surprised. So that's kind of been my thing so far.
Yeah, I'm actually
that you'd like to mention. Sorry, David.
Oh, they'd like to mention
any breweries that have really piqued your interest.
Infinite Brew is one. There's another called Days Brewery. Lucky Saint is also one. And a few which I've just saved on my Instagram and forgotten. But it's kind of weird. It's like, oh, I'm going to give up alcohol for my marathon training, but now I've just gone into 0% beer.
Yeah, it's interesting. I discovered a Big Drop maybe like a couple years ago. They're over in Ipswich, and they've kind of done the whole crowdfunding, you know, or like kind of investment thing like BrewDog did. And I think they've become quite big. And interestingly, I was back in the States for about a month before Christmas, and like you can't find those sort of 0.5% craft beers over there. Everyone drinks the stuff called ranch water. There's a name for it, but it's basically like hoppy water, not beer that the alcohol has been filtered out of. So I was actually really surprised that like this is a big thing here, and it just doesn't really seem to exist over there.
Interesting.
Because the Big Drop stuff is great.
Yeah, it is. So one thing I sort of discovered in my research and also going on some blogs and stuff like that is the sort of 0.5% is just will naturally taste better because it's still got a bit of ABV in it. Anything which is completely 0%, I think even my friend mentioned, like, it's sort of chemically removed, and that's where it can sort of like it just tastes of flavored water. But I respect a lot of breweries. Like, there's a Swedish one called Brulo, and they've like got what they say like dry hopped lager, dry hopped IPAs and stuff. So on the can you're like, oh, this should be really good, but it just tastes like a mango flavored water, if that makes sense. So my little discovery is if you find anything that's at least 0.5, it's going to taste better than a complete 0%.
Yeah, it definitely feels like a good market that needs to grow, because like, I mean, I love the idea of like being able to come home from work and just like pop a can and like have a kind of beer to unwind, but like I don't want to be drunk or hungover the next day, you know. So like that kind of super
yeah, but
low.
this is where like session IPAs sort of come into play, and you know, you can, it, don't get wrong, I love beer, but just right now for some reason I just want to be going for the low ABVs while doing my training.
Makes sense. And
go ahead.
I was just saying it makes sense especially if you're training.
Yeah,
you want to make sure your body's at the peak.
Let's hope so.
And you mentioned all your research and stuff. Does that include like running kit and like running shoes as well, or is that more just kind of like your nutrition?
No, nutrition I haven't really explored. I don't want to go that far into it, but it's kit. Like as you said, it's quite cold in London right now, so getting the right sort of gear to stay warm, like a 8-liter backpack to run with, like vests with hydration pouches and that kind of stuff, and the right footwear for different distances. It's fascinating, but we're definitely getting ripped off for just buying all this kit for minimal gain. I'm not a professional athlete, so why do I need like a carbon plated 300-pound shoe?
Yeah, I've only run half marathons, never full. I'd love to do a full someday, but I'm not like good enough to usually qualify for these things. But I really dig ultra shoes because they're kind of zero drop, you know, big toe boxes. And so for me, they've been the kind of sweet spot of, I used to run in barefoot style shoes. It's a big ultra fan. And one other thing I'd mention, I haven't read it yet, so I can't actually speak to it, but I bookmarked the other day, Outside Magazine did an article where one of their main runners had like given up energy gels and had replaced it with all natural foods from like your cupboard. So like peanut butter, bananas, et cetera. And it was like a big article about like his adventure into, or their adventure, I can't remember if it was a guy, of like non-purchased sports nutrition. Just like grocery store sports nutrition off the shelf stuff. So it could be worth a read.
Wow, cool. Yeah, I like that.
Cool. Well, I guess guess I can go next. I guess for me, the current interest is a bit of a garment thing, but also a bit of a content thing. So I've obviously been, selling a lot of my clothes that don't fit anymore, that I bought the wrong size. And when I was back at home over Christmas, I kind of acquired some new stuff. And I just want to kind of talk about this thing we're doing on the Instagram, which I'm calling the 5x1 reviews, which is basically five things you need to know about one rugged garment. And so usually what I'll do is like I'll sit down with, I don't know, a jacket or a pair of shoes or something and think about like what are the five most interesting things about that garment, right? So it could be a construction detail. It could be like a design detail, like what makes it kind of cool and interesting. Or sometimes it's kind of like notes around, well, maybe this pocket doesn't work the way I'd want it to, whatever. So sort of kind of breaking down and trying to kind of provide a critique of a garment in a short form fashion. So usually I'll use the Clips app, which is built into iOS, to kind of record the little pieces of content and then just pop it on Instagram and also YouTube as like a reel or like a short form video. So yeah, I'm just kind of keen to see how folks are resonating with those on our social media, and I'm hopefully going to probably try and do more. And I know Ilya, you've done some content in the past. I think when you got like those Flame Panda boots. So yeah, just kind of keen to hear from folks who listen to the podcast if you enjoy that kind of content and if you want to hear more of it, because across the group of us, we've got a whole bunch of different stuff that we've acquired and are wearing day to day. And it feels like no one's really doing a good job at the moment of kind of talking about garments and like what makes them interesting and kind of good, bad, how to make them better, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that's a fun way of exploring it. And yeah, if people are keen to for more of us to do that kind of thing, I'll be happy to chip in and help out.
Yeah, in some ways we're quite privileged, I guess, in that we are able to get our hands on a lot of cool stuff, whether it's because we're in London and there's good shops here, whether it's because we like have done a lot of research and kind of know niche brands that we want to seek out. And then also just the simple fact that each of us in the podcast have kind of different interests, I guess, means that we can kind of do a lot of the grunt work for folks and kind of let them know what's interesting to maybe buy or not buy and why. And I think one thing too is, you know, all the garments we've been reviewing so far are stuff that we've bought ourselves out of pocket, and we'll always continue to make sure that you're well informed, whether it's something we bought or whether it's something that someone gave us to review. It's like I'm big into board games, and there's a lot of this stuff in that industry, and people haven't always been above board about like why they have that board game and why they're reviewing it, i.e. like, did they get it for free? Did someone pay them to review it, et cetera? So I think it's super important that we always kind of be crystal clear about where this stuff comes from. And so it's, you know if there is bias or not.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone wants to send me stuff for free, then, you know, feel free.
Well, Standard and Strange seems to sponsor everybody, so maybe someday we'll be cool enough.
One day.
I'm kidding. But anyways, Ilya, do you have anything that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I've been reading Dilla Time, which is a book by Dan Charnas. And it covers, it's kind of an autobiography by Dan on J.D. or J. Dilla, who was a renowned hip-hop producer coming up in the early 90s, who passed away in the early 2000s. And what the book covers is his life, but also how he changed the soundscape of hip hop with his kind of unique production methods, especially his drum patterns, which a lot of other producers afterwards took on and used in their own production. So it's been really fascinating reading about that. I'm a big fan of music and hip hop, and this kind of really breaks down why, you know, the importance of what he did. Dan interviews different people around Jay Diller's life, who kind of give their insights into why he was important and, you know, how they were inspired by him. So alongside that, I'm kind of listening to his music, going back and, you know, revisiting some classic records that he was a part of, you know, including Tribe Called Quest, Far Side, obviously Slum Village, which was his own group, and then the production that he was doing for, you know, many other artists like Busta Rhymes and so on and so on. So yeah, it's been really interesting to kind of dig a little bit deeper about him as a person and also as a as an artist. So yeah, I've been really enjoying that, and yeah, definitely recommend it if you have any interest in that field.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know Jazz Cafe has been doing a lot of kind of throwback, tribute nights for different producers in London. And yep. Like tomorrow's the one for the Nujabes Japanese producer. And I think I saw, I don't know if it was Dilla, it might have been, but there's another one they announced like a couple months out where it's another kind of tribute night for a big hip hop producer. And I think that's kind of cool to see how like beat makers are getting a bit more of due respect, you know, whereas like normally so much about the MCs and kind of
well,
lyrics.
it's interesting in hip hop terms, at some points the producers were the most important, then they kind of went down, and you know, the rappers were the most important, and then they kind of came back. So there's this kind of, you know, wave of how important a producer is, you know, DJs as well. But yeah, you're right. Jazz Cafe, I think, have been doing it. I think even since, I think he performed at the Jazz Cafe years back. It could have been even like the year before he passed. And ever since that, they did a tribute show called Dilla Changed My Life. So yeah, I think they've had that every year or so. But now they're adding other producers and other artists in there. So that's nice to see.
It's an interesting one too, because like hip hop's been there in my life since my teenage years when I was into skating, and I've always noticed that like if the beat's not on, I can't get into the lyrics. It's really weird. Like you can have the coolest flow, but if the beat's not right, I just can't resonate with it. And so it's almost like the hip hop I like is sort of it's the hip hop that has beats that I'm really into.
It's production led for me as well. My way in is always through the beats and through the samples which are used. I'm always excited about, you know, finding out what sample the producer has used, which has, you know, expanded my music knowledge a lot to, you know, to different decades and different genres. So yeah, I'm with you there. It definitely has to have a great production for me to really connect with it.
Yeah, that's the same for me actually. I grew up listening to hip hop, and production value is number one. And I probably listened to so many tracks and albums, still wouldn't know the lyrics, but it's the beats that I know. And as you say, Ilya, like the sort of discovery and research going backwards of where they sampled it from jazz and soul. And if now I listen to something and it comes on with this bit, I'm like, oh my God, I recognize that. Yeah. But it's still that discovery. And so obviously so much respect for these producers who just knew so much, a plethora of knowledge in music, to just bring it from different different songs and make a new beat. I love that.
Yeah, for me that's one of the still the best moments when I hear a record and I recognize it because somebody has used it, you know, from years back, and I'm like, ah, this is where they've taken it from. And again, you know, I think rap gets a lot of bad rep for stealing, for misusing, for being not music, and even now. But I think as you go back and you listen to these things, you listen to the music, and you listen to how things were put together, and I think it definitely deserves a lot more respect and a lot more credit than it gets. So yeah, I'm really enjoying it. And you know, this that last year where I've kind of started doing a little bit more reels because I've started to enjoy doing a bit of video production, meshing beats and, you know, beat matching to the cuts has been really interesting for me as well. So yeah, that's it's a great book, and I'll definitely recommend it for people who are into hip hop and hip hop production and music in general.
One related note is I don't listen to it often, but the Broken Record podcast, they did one interview with Missy Elliott, and particularly she talked about just that section of like Timbaland and how he like became a producer and like how he was doing his beats and stuff. I thought that little piece was like really cool on its own.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite podcasts, Broken Record, with Rick Rubin and Malcolm Gladwell, I think he's involved as well with that. Yeah, it's definitely one of the best ones to check out. Tom, would you like to go next?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's been a little while. Hello, everyone. Again. yeah, I mean, recently we've just finished watching The Bear, which, as well as being a great series, also has a lot of good menswear in there. Mm. There's some great highlights in Capital Bandana, Mertzby Schwan and Tees, and all sorts. It's like, oh, I know that. Yeah. And they're all just like, whoever the costume department was in that film was just amazing. But a great series. I felt dragged a little bit in the middle, but the ending really just pays off for the whole thing. I don't know what you think, David.
Yeah. Two of my early days jobs were in commercial kitchens. So like my very first job was in a barbecue restaurant, like serving and prepping food. And I remember like stirring barbecue sauce with the oar. It was such a big giant vat of barbecue sauce. And then later I was an expediter at an Italian restaurant, which is like the one who's sort of project managing all of the dishes being cooked. Okay. And so in that sense, it like really, really resonated with me about the feel of it. It felt like being an industrial kitchen. And a good buddy of mine who owns the brand Steamboat Leather, he used to be a professional chef, and he was kind of saying the same. But one thing that I thought was just a bit funny is like they look so cool and like such great outfits, but there's like those garments would be completely destroyed in like 5 minutes in a commercial kitchen. It's like there's no way in hell you'd wear a white t-shirt into a commercial kitchen.
You're just thinking, where's the sauce?
Yeah. I mean, I guess if you're like bleaching the hell out of it and you're, you know, throwing it in there with like the linens and stuff that get, they get everything out of those kind of, you know, napkins and stuff, but they probably ruin your shirt while they're at it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a emotionally charged series though. Like the whole time you're actually sitting there like as stressed as I am. Cause like some episodes are just shouting from beginning to end. They're just shouting and shouting at each other. And you're like, fuck yeah, I can really feel this. Like it is intense. But yeah, well worth a watch if you haven't already.
It felt like heavy metal in TV form or something like that.
Yeah, it's mixed with like, you know, therapy session and all sorts. Like it's just you're actually like exhausted watching it almost at the end of an episode. You're like, oh god, my god, that's just. I mean, like one of my favorite episodes was where they accidentally do like a kids party, not accidentally do a kid. At a kid's party and then accidentally drug them all, which was very funny. And there's just all these kids on the floor like knocked out and they're like, oops.
Yeah, half the time I was watching, I was like, can you please turn the volume down, chef? You know, it's like so intense.
Maybe that's how we'll start referring to you. Yes, chef. Yeah, watch the first episode of The Last of Us as well. Oh, it's gonna be a good series. Like, was I'm in an R in, or like lots of people obviously saying it's very good, and I was like, oh, I'll wait till I watch it, and then whoa, it's good.
Do you know if it correlates to the first video game or if it's to both?
I think as far as people know, it's going to be the first game. I don't know how. I haven't completed the first game, unfortunately. I played a little bit and I was like, oh, this isn't Call of Duty, so I'll stop playing. but I think it's the first game's storyline, at least.
Yeah, because I haven't played 2 yet. I bought it, but I haven't played it. So I'm kind of wondering, like, should I watch it or should I wait till I've at least played the second game first?
Yeah, no, I'd say start watching it. Yeah, it felt like very well paced. You know, it's taken its time with kind of, you know, any kind of emotional scenes in there. So, yeah, it's going to be a good HBO style watch.
Yeah, I was really sad when they did the comic adaptation of Why the Last Man, which is kind of not too dissimilar in terms of kind of post-apocalyptic sort of thing, and then got canceled after one season. So I'm glad to hear that The Last of Us is actually doing really well, and is like off to rave reviews, and hopefully they'll kind of bring it through to a good conclusion and hopefully not go 10 seasons or whatever they did for The Walking Dead.
Yeah, no, I suppose because the games give it such a kind of, you know, box to fit in. It's like, you know, we know it's going to kind of go from A to B with, you know, whatever steps in between.
Is it following the game completely, or?
As far as I know, yes. I think it's the same characters and everything. I don't know whether they'll throw any kind of curveballs in, but the guy who made The Last of Us is one of the kind of co-producers. And then the director is the guy who done the Chernobyl film thing, which, you know, was like so rave reviewed because, you know, like they got the characters like looking exactly the same as, you know, the exact people who were there, and, you know, every single shot in like one of the rooms in like the nuclear reactors was an exact copy of, you know, the room in, you know, Chernobyl. So a very, very safe hands, I think.
It's interesting that you can do that in a good way, whereas something like Watchmen or 300 did that same kind of concept in a bad way.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you can see like the style that they're going for is, you know, pretty much spot on with what the game was trying to do, because you've got, I can't remember his name, David something. You know, the guy from Naughty Dog is in there. And I think, you know, he had a very clear vision with the game. You know, the game is stylistically, you know, quite unique. So, you know, that's going to be reflected in the series.
I think something like that is also easier to get right than something which is quite complex, like Watchmen, for example. It splinters off in so many different ways, whereas The Last of Us, you're just basically, you know, watching as these two characters make their way from point A to point B. And obviously they go via a long route to those points, but ultimately it's just that, isn't it? I'll look forward to checking that out.
Yeah, and then outside of that, obviously been working on new style of jeans. Woo! Is there any update, Ilya?
I haven't been in the factory for a little while, so I'm not sure. Last time I was there, they were being cut, as you know, which, you know, I sent you over the photos. I'm not sure when they are being sewn together, so it should be soon. Should be soon if they haven't, you know, started that already. So yeah.
But Tom, can't you just tell us? It looks like you're in the factory right now.
Let me just check. No, they're all busy.
We're all cracking jokes.
Yeah, cool. I'm excited for that to be made and to get it out there for people and give myself a new pair of jeans.
Chris, do you want to add a second item or?
No, I'm not quite sure what else.
Cool.
No, you can skim over me again.
Cool. Well, I'll mention a second one. So I bought a heavy duty domestic sewing machine last year, and I've been trying to kind of, well, my long term goal is I've got some shirt designs in my head, and I want to just make those shirts. I don't know if I'll ever like do a brand or anything, but I've got the ideas, and I was like, all right, well, first I need to learn how to actually like sew some of these things. So I can understand how they work before I ever try and actually like make my own designs. So I've gotten switched on to a brand called Thread Theory. It's a Canadian company, threadtheory.ca. Really impressed with what they offer. So basically it's kind of a rugged slash workwear slash a bit of everyday patterns. They've got kind of like different buckets of patterns they make, but they make and they design all the patterns themselves. And my friend Eddie, who some of us know, he I think was the one who mentioned them to me originally. But they've got some really nice patterns. You can go on their website. You can basically buy a PDF version, which you like print out on your home computer, and you just like tape together the pieces of the like multiple A4 or 8.5 by 11 sheets. Or they do kind of classic tissue patterns where you like, you know, you unfold and it's got all the kind of tissue paper and you cut it to the size you want. So I ended up buying their Fairfield, which is their kind of classic button down shirt pattern. And also they've got like a regular straight jean. Oh yeah, Fulford jeans pattern. And they're pretty popular and well known in the kind of DIY sewing world. So you can easily find them at most, I guess, haberdasheries, like in London. Ray Stitch has all their stuff. But really cool. I'm really impressed with the quality of the patterns. The instructions are really good. I found a few little typos here and there, but when I emailed them about kind of, you know, dimensions or things like that, they were super, super quick to get back to me. Also, because they're Canadian, they've got everything both in imperial and metric. So like if you're used to sewing in inches, they've got you covered. If you're used to sewing in centimeters, they've got you covered. And then lastly, they have these really cool like online instructions. So like I bought the Fairfield shirt and I can like go on and do like a online sew along where it's basically blog posts with some little videos here and there that kind of like walk you through the process of making your shirt, assuming you've got their pattern and are kind of are trying to make it. So it's a very nice way to have some instructional to go with their stuff. And I think lastly, it's just, to me, it's the biggest brand I've seen so far that's making, I mean, I hate to use the term rugged patterns, but patterns for stuff that we would want to wear. And I think it's really cool. And they even got some kind of really funny stuff, like you can make your own underwear or your own trunks, or they've got some kind of like more casual women's wear stuff. So they've got a whole gamut of different things. But and they also sell other patterns beyond their own on their website. So make sure you kind of know if you're looking at their patterns versus somebody else's. But yeah, really cool brand. And yeah, definitely check them out. Threadtheory.ca.
Yeah, their website looks really good. Nice mix of styles, which I'm sure are going to be really helpful for a lot of people who are interested in making stuff themselves.
Yeah, and somewhere on here they've got kind of like collections. You can get like their workwear collection, their kind of athleisure collection. So you can kind of narrow down to the particular type of patterns that you care about. Whereas like if you just kind of browse it from the top level, it's like, oh my God, they've got everything. But yeah, I'm a fan so far. Anything you'd like to add, Ilya?
Yeah, I'll add. I've been debating for a long time getting a film camera, which I finally decided to do last month, and I got myself a Nikon F3 with the advice of my friend Platon. And yeah, just kind of been enjoying the unknown, really, and just kind of starting fresh with it. Obviously, I enjoy photography and been really digging into that. But this felt like a really, you know, going back a few steps and trying something a little bit more analog, obviously, a little bit not instant. So yeah, I've been taking it to a few places I've been traveling yeah, I'm just kind of simplifying the process, I guess. And I'm still unsure, undecided whether I like it or not, but I'm at least, I thought, let me get this. I've had this itch which I've needed to kind of to scratch, and I'm at least I'm doing it now. So yeah, it's been interesting journey so far. I guess in the next few months I'll decide whether it's for me or not. But yeah, it's been a good time so far.
How are you getting your development done? Do you like have a dark room you have access to, or are you just like taking your roles and
I'm getting them developed by somebody else at the moment. If I decide to do this long term, then I'll look into developing myself. But I at the moment I want to just see whether I'm in this for the long haul, or it's just something that I've wanted to try and experiment with. So yeah, I'll see where that takes me. But yeah, at the moment, you know, if anybody is aware, film is very expensive to develop, to shoot, to acquire. It's it's not the easiest thing to get in your hands on, especially the quality film. So yeah, I'll see whether that's like I said, I'm still in the baby steps stage of it. But yeah, I thought I needed to try it, and yeah.
Out of interest, what would you shoot on analog that like you would say, oh, I don't like what warrants an analog shot versus a digital?
I don't think you have to make that distinction. It's more just about slowing down the shooting style. I think one of the reasons I want to do it is to become a better photographer, understand photography a little bit better. Whereas I think using a new camera, it's almost becomes very instant, very easy to some degrees, because the camera is doing a lot of the heavy lifting for you. And obviously you have to still compose and understand what kind of shots is going to look good, and you know, setting the scene and those kind of things. But with an analog, there's a little bit more time involved in making sure the settings are right, making sure you can't see exactly what you're shooting from, you know, on the screen. There's not that instant feedback that you get, which we're all used to, and that's one of the things I'm still discovering whether it's something I like or I don't like. There's a little bit of more mystery involved with it, so you have to be a lot more on the ball with what you're shooting. I wouldn't say there's necessarily, you use one or the other for one particular reason or not. I'm just using it for just day-to-day stuff that I might be interested in, or a bit of travel. Yeah, there's not really using it for work-based stuff at the moment, although I will do to test the waters out with. So yeah.
One thing that really blew my mind was when I got my first Micro Four Thirds camera some time ago, I picked up Brian Peterson's Understanding Exposure book. And as someone who had like not really ever shot with a manual camera before, digital but manual, that book was like mind-blowing how good it was in terms of like breaking down the science of exposure. And anyone I've ever talked to since that's like gotten into like proper photography, I'm always like lending them my copy of that book. It's a few editions old, but I was really impressed with how well that book kind of explains the science of it. It definitely helped me out.
Well, if you don't mind bringing it to one of the hangs, that would be I'll definitely be interested in checking it out.
Cool. It may be in the States with my sister. Okay, so I lent it to her last, but I'll double check and see if I got it.
If not, I'll pick it up. I'll pick it up. It's always good to learn and to reinforce or to find out new things about it. So yeah. How about you, Tom?
In terms of cameras.
in terms of your interests, is there any other interest that you would like to mention?
Well, not a lot else for me. Starting a new job on Monday, so still in the Octopus Energy world, but moving to the electric vehicle side. I don't know how to drive, and I don't have an electric vehicle, but gonna sell them. Which I feel like I can sell anything at this point, so it's fine.
Yeah, I moved home recently, and I had Octopus at my previous home, and have them again now at my new place, and Yeah, I jumped on the phone with one of your colleagues, and they were super helpful. Really, can't remember the gent's name at this point, but I probably have his email. But yeah, really cool company. I think they, especially with the kind of energy crisis going on in the UK right now, around like cost of energy and stuff, they were very, very helpful in what was a complicated situation. So shout out to them.
Yeah, one of the few companies I think that want to try and help people as much as possible. But, you know, often we're shackled by the industry and what the government want to do. You know, if we had our way, we would, you know, unlink renewable energy from gas prices so that, you know, if you are on a renewable tariff, then, you know, it'd be a lot cheaper. But that's not what the government wants to do. So, yeah, it's mad, 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 mad. But I won't talk too much about work because, yeah. I feel like lots of people have asked me about it this weekend, and I've just been like, oh, God. But it happens, you know. You're like that person to talk about that thing. So, yeah. Oh, yeah, and been redecorating my house. So, doing a bit of painting, getting the old rollers out. And, yeah, and going to put in some, like, new shelving, put some pictures up. And, yeah, just because, you know, interest rates are really high. So, we're probably going to stay in this flat for a little while. So, we're like, yeah, we'll make it our own. So maybe at the next podcast I'll be sitting at a different desk.
The place I'm in now, the guy who owns it, I'm renting at the moment, is a big film buff, and is one of the second bedroom upstairs, he had built a wooden shelving system for DVDs. Like, it's like almost like a whole wall is like a DVD shelf. And I'm like, man, this is actually a perfect setup for a Warhammer model display. So I'm recording in my kitchen so that you guys don't have to see the embarrassment. That's like a whole bunch of toy soldiers on one wall.
No, I've requested to get a little display cabinet somewhere because I've just got too many models that need to be out.
They need to be seen.
Definitely all that painting I put in, all that effort. And yeah, then they go in a big box. Ilya's shaking his head. He's like, no, make it stop. Andy's not here.
30 years. Swiftly.
Yeah, 30 years from now, he'll be like, shit, you guys were right all along about those toy soldiers. Like, I should have jumped on board.
Yeah, because it's all about Henry Cavill now and bringing Warhammer to Amazon Prime. That's going to be going to be the next thing.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what the show is or movie. I guess it could be either or at this point. But yeah, I'm stoked. I think it could be fun to see that world done in a good high-end film or TV production way. So could be cool.
It could definitely be like kind of the next sci-fi fantasy big kind of franchise for mainstream media. So yeah, looking forward to that. Fingers crossed.
On that note, if folks haven't watched it, watch The Peripheral. That's definitely, I mean, the TV show is nothing like the book so far because I'm only like halfway through the book, but the TV show is amazing. And to me, it's the most thought-provoking science fiction I've watched probably since The Expanse. So it's on Amazon Prime and it's very good.
Okay, yeah, give that a look.
Cool. I guess anything else for anyone else? Cool. All right, well, maybe we'll go ahead and wrap up here for today. So thank you again, Chris, from coming on the podcast to talk about Malix and for keeping us warm and cozy in these cold times. And for anyone who's listening, please rate and review us wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, please follow us on Instagram at Sons of Selvage Podcast. Lastly, message us on Instagram with any questions you'd like us to discuss in a future episode. And reach out if you'd like to come hang out on our Discord server. And so on that note, thanks everybody and have a good day.